Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Prodigal by Charles Lambert. Narrated by Matthew Lloyd Davis. And what's romance? Usually a nice little tale where you have everything as you like it. Here rain never wets your jacket and gnats never bite your nose. And it's always daisy time. D. H. Lawrence. Part 1. 2012. 1. Jeremy. The call comes when he least expects it. He's tidying away what's left of lunch. Some cold meat wrappers, a crust of baguette. When the phone rings, in that short-tempered, peremptory way machines have. He almost doesn't answer it. He's been fending off unwanted offers of insurance, unlimited broadband, crates of discount wine. For months now. His name must be on a list somewhere. Jeremy Eldritch, sucker, with a 5-star rating after it to indicate the extent of his gullibility. Or maybe 4. Why be so hard on himself always, so unforgiving? These past few weeks he's found himself saying no with unexpected ease, behaving with a brusqueness he's superficially ashamed of, but deeply pleased, even smug, to find as part of his telephone repertoire. I'm getting bad, he said to himself. Even my mother would be ashamed of me. I'm finding my teeth after all these years of pandering to people I've never met, and would almost certainly hate to the deepest pit of my heart if I did, as they would me. He throws the paper and crust towards the bin 2 feet away, wipes his greasy hands on a tea towel hanging from the oven door, and picks up the phone. It's his older sister, Rachel. You'd better get back here, she says. He's on his way out. Jeremy lives on the 4th floor of a building 10 minutes' walk away from Place de Clichy, on the 17th arrondissement, his favourite part of Paris. In the days when people read Henry Miller long before he lived here himself, he'd used the man's Quiet Days in Clichy as a sort of cultural landmark. Not exactly my idea of quiet, he'd say, referring to the book. More like a movable fuckfest of very little literary worth. And people would leap to Miller's defence, or not, depending on their age and sex and artistic pretension. Or look at him with an anxious glance, surprised to hear such language from such an apparently mild and amenable man. This is the smallest flat he's ever lived in. Just under 18 meters square, a truncated cupboard masquerading as a kitchen, an all-purpose living space not much larger than a decent walk-in wardrobe, a bathroom small enough to shower while crapping and still be able to rinse one's razor under the tap. It was sold to him as a studio, and might even have had room for a desk or drawing board of some kind if he hadn't squeezed a double mattress in the space between the cooker and the door to the bathroom. Now a sort of improvised futon Jean-Paul produced by lifting the mattress up with the sort of strength the adrenaline of rage produces, and flinging it against the wall. It skulks there, a drunken observer, its back against the plaster, a sheet hanging rakishly down from one corner, while Jeremy eats and writes and reads at the round wooden table that takes up most of the rest of the room. Jeremy sleeps on the horizontal part of the mattress, a not-quite-rectangular rhomboid with a couple of pillows thrown at the wider end and a duvet gathered at the other. He waits for Jean-Paul to come back and sort things out. He has been waiting for just over 2 months. What made him buy the flat, other than its price and the fact that he likes small places, prefers them even, was the honey-coloured parquet and the window, which reaches to the ground, and gives onto a courtyard and blue-grey roofs of weathered zinc, and is altogether too splendid for the room in which it finds itself. A situation, Jeremy feels, that has some affinity to his. His favourite position is to sit at one side of the table with his back to the mattress, looking out through the wide open window, his feet on a small wooden box that once held a magnum of champagne, and is now filled with letters from the time when people wrote them. His arms crossed loosely above his stomach in the restful position of a man on his own tomb. He'll have a book somewhere near his chair, or his laptop, or the manuscript he's working on. but will have abandoned it to watch the gently urban wind in the leaves of the courtyard's single tree, which may be a lime, or may be something quite different, but which he continues to think of as a lime. He'll be watching the leaves as the wind turns them white and then dark again, and the movement of the young man in the window opposite, who has no time at all for Jeremy, and who wanders around his slightly larger studio in pyjamas or less, a large bowl of coffee cupped in his elegant white hands, and whose presence contributed in no small measure to Jean-Paul's final fit of jealous rage. Jeremy has been in this flat for the past 17 years, in or near Batignolles for almost 25, in Paris for 34, give or take the odd few months elsewhere, for reasons of the heart or penury. He was dispatched here by his mother when no other solution seemed feasible, with the address in his wallet of a girl she'd known at school, who'd married someone in publishing, the business card of a hotel she'd stayed in briefly before she married his father, in whose company, she didn't say, some traveller's checks for the first few months, and a copy of a guide to the churches of Paris she'd claimed to have bought in a local jumble sale, trusting that some kind of solace might be gained from it. He studied the names as the ferry pitched its way towards Calais. Saint-Denis, Saint-Gervais-et-Saint-Protais, Saint-Germain-des-Prés. What a saintly city it must be, he mused. He'd read French at university, but spent his year out in Montpellier and only passed through Paris twice. He was saving it for when he was in love, he told himself, which made it feel vast and hopeless. The depth and span of its stations dispirited him. The elegance of its men, each one of them single and aloof and self-sufficient. His mother's hotel, though, set him right within hours, when one of the kitchen hands followed him back to his pokey single-bedded room and gave him a lesson in a brusque and richly communicative sexual argo his 3 interrupted years at Exeter hadn't prepared him for at all. So this is Paris, he thought. His face in the pillow as a slim Algerian whose name he never caught left teeth marks in his shoulder. His mother's friend's husband had turned out to own not a publishing house, but a sizable printing works to the south of Paris. He caught the train out there one late autumn morning, enjoying the sense of being a foreigner these journeys within the larger journey always heightened. I don't belong here, he found himself repeating in mantric rapture, in time with the leafless poplars that lined the railway track as soon as the city and its suburbs were behind him. I don't belong here. And its counterpoint. And so I'll stay. He was met at the station by a short man with a large moustache, who introduced himself as the general manager of the works, which impressed Jeremy, as it was no doubt meant to. The man drove him to a smallish factory on the outskirts of the town, with a row of sedately smoking chimneys, their off-white pads of vapour sloping away to the side in infantile chorus, like something from an impressionist painting. The printing works were behind this, in a squat red-brick manoir-like building, from which came the sound of machinery, an arrhythmic thudding that nonetheless reminded Jeremy of his journey, and gave him a sense of inevitability he realized he had been craving. He wondered what was being printed behind such mundane walls. What had seemed like a courtesy visit took on a new importance. The manager walked him round the works, explaining each stage of the process, but Jeremy's French was barely up to it, and what he did understand made it all seem more mysterious. He watched a young man his age set type, his hands like birds after seed, and didn't want to know any more than that, that hands had made it. He heard the presses at work, glistening black giant looms weaving words, or text, as he had learned to call it during supervisions with his teachers, always with the epithet holy in his head, as though the words were measured out by gods who wished both to remain secret and to be obeyed. The author was dead, but the printer survived, the actual artisan of the text, a man no older than he was, fine-featured, stooped like a heron over water. All of these images of birds tumbling one after the other. Perhaps there was some sort of narcotic in the ink they used, he thought, as he stumbled behind his brisk gesticulating guide until he was suddenly in an office, the distant thud of the printing attenuated by music he couldn't place. Something that reminded him of Satie, but wasn't. A man unfolded himself from behind a desk and held out his hand. He announced in rumbling, accented English that he was Jeremy's mother's friend's husband, presumably to show off his grasp of the genitive. Jeremy sat down in the seat provided and let the man talk for a little until he could make up his mind about what he thought. The man was tall, large-boned, with long, slightly thinning hair and expressive hands he was clearly proud of. He'd catch sight of them suddenly and pause, as if surprised by such contingent elegance. His name, he said, was Armand. Jeremy wasn't sure which name this was, his first or second. He glanced above the man's head to what looked like a university degree, framed in gilt, and saw the name Armand Regnier in blood-red copperplate across its centre. The truth, thought Jeremy as he cautiously glanced around the rest of the room, its cabinets and glass-fronted bookcases, its telephones and in-trays, its general air of business being conducted, was that he knew nothing. He had a degree in a language he could read but barely speak without being aware of an anxious, even supercilious, look appearing on the other person's face. He would have to work harder, work faster, he told himself, if only to stay in the same place, wherever that was, let alone get out of it. He hated his hotel room. The kitchen hand was avoiding him or had simply left. He might have been traceable if only Jeremy had discovered his name. He might have been able to run him to ground, to leave for Algiers with his Berber love, to lose himself in the desert as whatever his name had done, in the sheltering sky, a book he loved, except that the hero had died, which Jeremy would rather avoid. While all this ran like water through his head, Grenier was explaining the workings of the printing industry in fluent, heavily accented English. Jeremy heard little and would have understood less. He had an aversion to practical knowledge of any kind. He wondered why everyone should want him to know so much about the intricacies of book and magazine production and commercial printing, and only later asked himself, as the train took him back to Paris, whether he might or not have been the victim of a plan cooked up by his mother and Hilary, or whoever she was, to keep him busy until his father would have him back, assuming he would. Busy, and even if it weren't too much to ask, involved in some sort of business, a money-making activity of some sort. Money, that would be the type of thing to win his father over. For Jeremy actually to be capable of making money. Slumped into his chair, he watched the Frenchman's floating hair and almost verbal hands in a wordless daze, until he was startled into attention.
"Your mother has told us you write," said Grenier.
"Well, yes," said Jeremy. "I mean, not really."
"Come, come, mon ami, no modesty, please."
Grenier stood up.
"You will accompany me now to my second office, where I have something I wish to show you."
Jeremy followed him along a narrow corridor with a suspended quality about it. Metal-framed windows overlooked a sloping zinc-covered roof at one side, the other side lined with advertisements for household goods of various types, detergents, domestic appliances, cosmetics for women, shampoos for men with prematurely greying hair. There was a house style, crude, slightly retro but knowing, a nod towards the Nouvelle Vague, but pop-arty as well. The style he recognised immediately when Grenier opened the door at the end of the corridor and, walking him to a tilted draughtsman's table in the middle of the room, pointed down to the sheet of paper on its surface.
"This is the front cover of a little publication we plan to export to your country," said Grenier.
A woman has been stretched, face down across what appears to be a stone altar. Her flimsy clothes have been torn away,
and her ankles and wrists attached to usefully placed metal loops by flimsy golden chains. What looks like a conquistador's helmet lies on the floor beside her. She's blonde, with high round buttocks that already appear to have been beaten a deepening rose. Behind her, a man in a feathered headdress and bulging loincloth is holding a whip and smirking as he lifts it. Across the top third of the cover, in the sort of jagged font used for 1950s science fiction movies, are two words. Montezuma's Revenge.
It is only a working title, naturally, said Grenier. Our private joke. Intestinal, yes? We would like to find something with a little more, how do you say, libido.
Jeremy, mute with embarrassment, nodded as Grenier squeezed his arm above the elbow, almost tight enough to hurt.
Perhaps you can help us?
With the title?
Grenier shook his head, bared his large great teeth in a grin.
With the book.
Jeremy puts the phone down and stares out of the window, his eyes misted over against every expectation. He sits there for what might be minutes, or tens of minutes, the leaves on the tree in the courtyard outside almost motionless, as though they were also waiting for some further change to take place, some further news to arrive. But the air is still. After however long it is, he reaches down and picks up the laptop beside the chair and reads what he has written that day. Lady Mirabel held back the curtain with her slim white hand so that her view into the formal garden was uninterrupted. Beds of pink and yellow roses meandered gracefully towards the lake below. But Lady Mirabel's attention was less on the scented array of blooms than it was on the gardener, only recently employed, whose name she had still not discovered. Against regulations, he had taken off his shirt in an attempt to cool down from his exertions, and was standing no more than 30 feet from the house, his lustrous hair tied back from his strong brown neck, his smooth skin glistening in the late morning sun as if waiting for the birch that would duly arrive if she decided to rebuke him for his shirtless state. Lady Mirabel lifted her Spanish fan to her face and agitated it, her bosom rising and falling. She was about to sit down when a sound behind her caused her to turn.
"I have some bad news for you, my lady,"
said Grenier, the estate manager and her family's most trusted servant.
"Bad news?"
Her voice was faint.
"Your father, my lady, my Lord Clichy, he's... Oh, my lady."
Lady Mirabel gave a gasp. Dropping the fan to the parquet floor, her delicate fingers grasped the heavy brocade of the drawing-room curtain for strength.
"He's dead. My father's dead."
"You must come with me, my lady."
"Thus life imitates art," thinks Jeremy. That sentimental fool Oscar Wilde was right. He writes, "Bloody good riddance," said Lady Mirabel with a casual but heartfelt laugh. "The selfish bastard deserves to die."
Then reads the words aloud in a trembling voice, a faint voice, and pauses for a moment before deleting them.
Not yet, he thinks. Not now. It is early afternoon.
He puts the laptop down and covers his face with both hands, shaking with unexpected grief. 2. Rachel. Rachel is waiting at St. Pancras International, by the branch of Marks and Spencer nearest the Eurostar exit. She's been shopping. Jeremy should have been here an hour ago but missed his train, and texted her when she was already on her own train to London, thereby wasting her morning in a way that was so typical of her brother, and of his hopelessness, she can hardly bring herself to feel angry about it. She's made use of the time to buy some stuff she can pop in the microwave, which will make it easier. A couple of curries, a steak and kidney pudding, fish cakes, various sorts of vegetables she doesn't even have to wash. How easy life is these days, she thinks, with a wriggle of resentment. If only it had always been so simple. At least she wouldn't have to listen to his carping about her cooking, and how they do things this way and that way in France, and how infinitely preferable it is to anything anyone does this side of the Channel. No wonder he's getting fatter by the visit, all that goose liver and fussed about with potatoes. Although she hasn't seen him for almost 3 years, is it? That time he came with some boyfriend who didn't speak a word of English she could understand, with Jeremy swearing blind he was fluent, and she was cloth-eared, and just didn't want to understand. She can't imagine how anyone might want to sleep with him, which she feels is a blessing. Their father asked her quite recently, before he retired to his bed, "You don't suppose lesbians always use dildos, do you?" As though she might be expected to know. It was one of his more lucid days, and they'd been watching Loose Women while she was gathering up the lunch plates to leave for Dara. She told him to keep his dirty thoughts to himself. But she can't help wondering the same sort of thing about men. Men together, that is. Does Jeremy play the woman? She asks herself as people sweep out through the exit. Is that what they do? She has a sudden mental picture of Jeremy in a bra and knickers, his hair done up in a bun like some awful vision of a sports mistress in her dismal privacy. She glances at her watch. 65 minutes late. She has a feeling there's another M&S just round the corner from here, which is bound to be where he'll go first. Murphy's Law being, as always, in operation. He's probably standing there now with one of his silly hats in his hand and his canvas rucksack on his shoulders. Absurdly, for a man of his age, he's been dragging the thing round for decades. "Get yourself a trolley case," she's told him. "No one cares anymore. It isn't feminine." But he won't listen. He never does, not to her anyway. And now she's going to have to tell him that their father no longer knows who she or anyone is in any reliable way, and that in the 3 days that have passed since she called, he has said no more than a handful of meaningless words, if words are what they were, none of which expressed the least desire to see his son, although God knows that's nothing new. He's expressed no desire to see Jeremy in the past 3 decades, as far as she can remember, though he's mentioned him often enough. Jeremy this, Jeremy that. She wishes he hadn't. He's doubly incontinent as well, but she'll let that pass. Why put Jeremy off before he's even home? And here he is, trailing along like some teddy bear in the hands of a child he's too dim-witted to see. "Jeremy!" she calls out and waves. And he gives her one of his half-hearted smiles and slopes across. "Where did you pop out from?" she says, turning her head away from him as he kisses her cheek, so that what he gets is the patch of rough skin beside her ear where she's plucked out the odd hair. He'll be diving in for a second one, she thinks, and steps back, giving his shoulders a brisk shake that will do as well as anything else to express her affection. She hates him when he gets too close. She expects him to smell of something French, like cheese. All very confusing here, he says vaguely, readjusting his rucksack. I'm not sure it's entirely an improvement, this new station. You'd better get used to things changing, Rachel says, with grim satisfaction, because it will be amusing to see him befuddled and caught off guard. Apart from the sheer fun of it, his bemusement will give her the advantage she needs to make sure he doesn't take over at this point in the game, now that the old man is barely with them any longer. It would be too bad if Jeremy simply walked in and took control after decades of frittering his time away in Paris, of all places, like some alcoholic American novelist between the wars. She's been reading a lot of them recently. Faulkner, Hemingway, Fitzgerald. Sitting beside the bed with the television headphones clipped onto her father's face like a bridle, looking up now and then to make sure he's still alive as one property show is succeeded by the next. She's working her way through a list of the 100 greatest novels from a book her neighbour gave her for Christmas, though she can't imagine what the criteria might have been that allowed some of them into the paddock, nor why her neighbour should have thought she'd want the book in the first place. She decided to regard it as a challenge. Most of the novels she's had to order, which makes her wonder exactly what purpose the public library is supposed to serve if it doesn't have a single work of classic fiction. If all it can dish up is horror, large print P.D. James, and Jeremy's latest offering,
if you're prepared to deal with the looks you get.
"I suppose you've had something to eat on the train," she says, nodding briskly before he can answer. "So we'll be getting on, shall we? Don't want to keep Daddy waiting."
"How is he?" says Jeremy.
His voice sounds tired.
"Away with the fairies most of the time," she says, not looking at him, staring at the flow of commuters that separates her from her goal with an angry, affronted glare. "Still, you'll see soon enough."
"You've left him alone?"
What she could say, what she wants to say is, "And what business is that of yours? You washed your hands of him years ago. You walked out on us both to lead your own selfish life in France."
But there will be time for that later, when they're both at home, and he can see the lie of the land himself, that it will hit home harder. For now she shakes her head.
"There's Dara with him."
He probably doesn't even remember who Dara is.
"And we've got a sitter who comes in when she's needed. It's all provided by the government. Extraordinary, really. He'd probably hate it if he knew. You know what he thinks about nanny states."
He nods. "Yes," he says, and from his tone she feels as though what he has heard is not what she has said, but what she thought. Later on the train, he says, "I didn't expect you to come up to London to meet me." He's leaning forward, swinging his hat between his knees. His face crumpled with concern she can't help but see is mawkish. For a moment he reminds her of their mother in one of her moods of wanting to know all about them, as though they would tell her everything, all their secrets, succumb to her simply because she wanted it, because the mood to want it had possessed her for a moment. She'd have had a magazine in her hand or the receiver of the phone, and this whim would have distracted her from the call she was about to make, from the article about some person she didn't know from Adam, from the recipe she'd subject them to the following day. And then, like a puff of smoke, the moment would pass.
Jeremy is like her mother, she thinks, for the thousandth time.
So what does that make me? What am I left with?
"You think I should have stayed with him, I suppose," she says, bridling.
She won't be criticised by someone who's given so little.
The man sitting next to her turns his head in her direction. She must have raised her voice without meaning to. He fiddles with the volume on his mobile, and the dull pumping sound of some dreadful pop music becomes audible to her left, as she's cut out from his life again. His elbow is touching hers, as though she were part of the train itself, part of the fittings. If she were alone, she'd move. Jeremy is staring through the window at an industrial estate. Low prefabricated buildings behind barbed wire, graffiti-daubed walls, waiting for her to carry on. She's caught him with his eyes on the man beside her more than once.
"No, no, not at all," he says, finally, turning back to look at her. "I'm just surprised. You don't usually."
He smiles.
"It's nice to be met. I'm hardly ever met."
"He's perfectly well looked after," she says.
"Honestly, Rachel, the last thing I want to do is upset you. I was trying to express my gratitude."
"What makes you think I'm upset?"
He leans back in the seat and sighs quietly, which makes her feel it's all her fault. After a moment, he lifts his hat towards the window. "Just look at it. We could be anywhere," he says. "Anywhere in the world. People making things nobody needs in the ugliest surroundings possible."
"We'll be in Rochester in 5 minutes," she says. "You can look at the castle then. I imagine that's more to your taste."
He smiles again. "Medieval bloodshed? Oh, yes."
His eyes flicker back to the man, who has started to agitate his leg in time to whatever he's hearing.
"I think you've been wonderful," Jeremy says, and he reaches across to rest his hand for a second on her knee. "I wouldn't have done what you've done."
She sniffs.
"Yes, well, it's not over yet."
"That will teach him," she thinks, as the train grinds to a halt outside the station.
"You'd better get your rucksack down ready. We don't want to miss our connection."
They're on the next train when she says,
"You didn't need to go all the way to London, you know. You could have got off at Dartford. I'd have driven over. It would have been easier for everyone."
"I didn't think," he says after a moment, and she isn't sure if he's heard her or is simply responding to sound and tone the way her horses do. A vague sense of reproach,
of the need to apologize. She's about to explain how typical this is of him not to think, when she remembers how much she welcomed the chance to get away.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?